Welcome to the Deep Dive. We dig through complex stuff, sometimes really dense source material, to pull out the key insights you can actually use. Today, we're getting into something that honestly feels incredibly relevant right now, that feeling of global overwhelm, the meta crisis people talk about, ecological, political, spiritual, all kind of swirling together. It's tempting to see them as separate issues, right? But what if they're symptoms of something, well, deeper, a kind of foundational glitch in how we see the world?
Exactly.
Our source today is this really fascinating work, From Cross to Crossing, Reclaiming the Christic Pattern Through Triality, Symbolic Recursion, and the Grammar of Coherence.
It sounds like a mouthful.
No, it is comprehensive, yeah. But it pulls together the theology, cosmology, symbolic logic, ethics, a lot. Our mission here is to unpack the core argument, how our inherited symbols might actually be fragmenting this, and what this new grammar it proposes could offer for, you know, healing and integration. Think of this as a shortcut, maybe, to a perspective that could genuinely shift how you look at things. Personal struggles, global challenges. We're hoping for some real aha moments.
Okay, let's try and unpack this. It sounds like a pretty radical reframing.
It really is. The work argues pretty convincingly that this meta-crisis we feel isn't just, you know, a coincidence of many problems hitting at once. It's described as a deeper structural and symbolic disorder. Basically, a rupture in the coherence, the kind of shared meaning that used to hold our human world together.
A rupture in coherence.
Yeah, think of it as a crisis of coherence. Our old systems, religious, scientific, political, economic, they're just not equipped anymore. They can't handle the complexity, and they're failing to transmit meaning effectively. They're sort of buckling. Right. So if it's structural, not just, say, bad luck or bad decisions, where does this framework say the root cause actually lies?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting. The core argument is that a central driver is our dominant dualistic logic.
Dualistic logic. You mean like black and white thinking?
Exactly. The way Western thought, especially, tends to slice the world into these binary pairs. Mind, body, spirit, matter, good devil, use them, you name it. And the problem arises when these divisions become absolute rigid, when there's no bridge, no connection. The source calls this pathological fragmentation.
Pathological fragmentation. Wow.
Yeah, it's strong language. But the point is, this isn't just abstract philosophy. This kind of thinking actively generates conflict. It fuels domination. It creates deep disconnection. And crucially, it blocks what the text calls the emergence of the relational third.
Relational third. What's that?
That's the key. It's that dynamic space between the opposites. Not a wishy-washy compromise, but a space where differences can be held, interacted with, and actually transformed into something new, something whole. Dualism shuts that down.
Okay, I think I'm following. So if dualism is a core problem, how does a symbol as central as the Christian cross fit into this picture? The source seems to take a critical look at how it's often been used.
It does, yeah. Mm. It suggests that the cross, originally a potent symbol of transformation, of passing through something difficult, often became ossified. It hardened into a static form.
Static? How so?
Instead of being a guide for navigating change, it sometimes became a symbol imposing a burden. The text talks about maladaptive crosses, interpretations that became harmful, like in theology, maybe an overfocus on divine wrath or substitutionary atonement that emphasizes guilt or this idea of inherited sin. In culture, you might see it as glorifying suffering unnecessarily or shaming anyone who deviates from the norm. And psychologically, it can show up as that harsh inner critic, that internalized judgment, splitting ourselves into good and bad parts without any real path to integration. That third space is missing.
So a symbol that could have been about passage became, well, like you said, a burden, almost a tool for control in some cases. You said earlier it's like the map became a cage.
That's a really good analogy. The work uses the phrase from archetype to architecture. It shifted from a dynamic archetypal pattern to a fixed architecture, a template for a symbolic order built on exclusion, sacrifice, and domination, losing that original recursive integrating potential.
Wow. And this isn't just about the cross, is it? The source mentions other points where this kind of dynamic potential was lost.
Exactly. It points to what it calls lost thresholds in Christian history. For example, the early debates about the Trinity, it argues, sometimes obscured the underlying idea of a deeply relational ontology, the idea that reality is relationship, fundamentally.
Yeah.
Or historical events like the Great Schism between Eastern and Western Christianity in 1054, seen here as a kind of death of dialogue. Even the Reformation, while bringing freedom, sometimes led to fragmentation without symbolic recursion, meaning new divisions formed without a built-in way to eventually reintegrate. And it looks broader, too, across the Abrahamic thresholds, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. It suggests that each, despite powerful beginnings rooted in dynamic relation, often saw a shift towards codification, towards institutionalization, or a very juridical orthodoxy. The net effect, according to this framework, was often an exile of the third, that mediating, dynamic, integrating principle got pushed aside.
That's quite a perspective, the exile of the third. So what happens then when a whole society, or even just us as individuals, loses that capacity to mediate, to find that third way? Where's the way back?
And that brings us right to the heart of the proposed solution, triality.
Triality, okay.
If dualism, that binary logic, is the root of the fragmentation, then triality is presented as the antidote. It's defined as a logic of coherence arising through the relational third. Crucially, it's not about finding a middle ground compromise between two opposites. It's recognizing a deeper principle where coherence, wholeness, emerges from the interaction across difference. The third doesn't cancel the two. It transforms their relationship.
Okay, coherence emerging through difference, not by eliminating it.
Precisely. And here's where it gets really mind-bending, as the source points out. This isn't just a neat philosophical idea someone cooked up. Triality seems to be a pattern woven into reality itself.
How so? Where do we see it?
Well, the examples are pretty stunning. Well, in fundamental physics and math, you find things like spinate triality.
Right.
Or mathematical structures called octonions. Now, we don't need to get lost in the math.
Ooh, okay.
Right. But the point is, these are deep structures showing that some systems don't resolve neatly into pairs. They inherently require a threefold symmetry, a triadic structure, to be coherent. It's built into the blueprint, you might say.
Wow, okay, so it's in the math.
And it's in biology.
Yeah.
The text highlights triplets as the structural unit of emergent systems. Think about the genetic code, the triplet codon. Three DNA bases code for one amino acid, the building blocks of proteins.
Right, I remember that from school.
Or embryology, the three-layered organization of the early embryo. Ectoderm, mesoderm, endoderm. These three layers give rise to everything in the body, even the triune brain model, brainstem, limbic system, neocortex working together, hopefully coherently.
Okay, this is really connecting some dots. DNA, embryos, the brain. It's not just an idea, it's like physically there.
And it extends right into our psychology and nervous system. Think about Stephen Porges' polyvagal theory. It describes this hierarchical triality in our autonomic nervous system. You've got the ancient dorsal vagal system that's the freeze response, then the sympathetic system, fight or flight, and then the more recently evolved ventral vagal system. This acts as the relational third.
Relational third?
It's the system that enables social engagement, feeling safe with others, emotional regulation. Without that ventral vagal third online, we tend to flip between shutdown and hyperarousal. It mediates our connection, our safety.
Makes sense. And you mentioned meaning and language too.
Yeah, the work brings in Charles Sanders Peirce, a philosopher of logic and semiotics. His model of meaning-making is triadic. There's a sign, like a word, an object, what it refers to, and crucially, an interpretant.
Interpretant.
That's the understanding or the mental effect produced in the mind. And that interpretant can then become a new sign, leading to this ongoing, evolving process of interpretation. Meaning isn't fixed. It emerges recursively through this three-part dance. The interpretant is the dynamic third.
Okay, wow. So triality is everywhere, from math to meaning. But how do we use this? If it's the antidote, how do we apply it to the mess, to the metacrisis? The source mentions a grammar.
Exactly. If triality is the pattern, tati is the practice. T-A-T-I. It stands for tend, align, transcend, integrate.
Okay.
It's presented as the functional expression of triality, a kind of universal symbolic grammar of transformation. Four movements, but they're recursive, like a spiral, for navigating any threshold, any challenge, big or small.
All right, break those down for me. Tend.
Tend is about bringing compassionate attention to what's actually present, especially if it's pain, a wound, confusion, really feeling it, acknowledging it without judgment.
Okay. Align.
Align is about discerning truth within that situation, what's really going on. It involves connecting with context, finding inner coherence, maybe aligning with your values or a deeper wisdom.
Got it. Transcend. That sounds big.
Transcend here means a symbolic release. It's the letting go, the death of the old pattern, the outdated belief, the way of being that no longer serves life. It's crossing the threshold.
And integrate.
Integrate is the crucial step of weaving the new insight, the released energy, the lessons learned back into your life, into your being. It's creating a new, more coherent whole, A new normal, you could say.
So it's a cycle. Tend, align, transcend, integrate, like an algorithm for growth.
You can think of it that way. A reliable grammar, the source calls it, for meeting fragmentation with pattern. It applies everywhere. Healing trauma, learning a skill, even social change. Think about trauma healing again. Mm-hmm. You have to tend to the hurt, align with safety and body wisdom, transcend the old story or release the charge, and then integrate that experience into a stronger sense of self. It's a roadmap.
That feels very practical, actually.
Yeah.
Which leads us into the next part, where this framework looks at the Christic pattern again, but through this lens of triality and tati. How does it reframe Jesus' life as triality incarnate?
Yeah, this is where it connects back powerfully. The idea is to see Jesus' life less as a set of doctrines and more as a profound pattern of transformation, a living demonstration of that tati grammar.
How so? Can you give examples?
Well, look at his ministry. He tends constantly to suffering, to the marginalized. He aligns fiercely with what he calls the kingdom of God, a different order of reality based on love and justice. His crucifixion becomes the ultimate transcendence, not just physical death, but a symbolic death of the old broken ways of being, the limitations of the ego, the violence of the empire.
Okay.
And then the resurrection is framed as the ultimate integration, not just coming back to life, but embodying a new relational presence. The Christic field becomes distributed, available, not locked in one person.
Wow, that reframes the story completely, doesn't it? Christ, not just as a figure, but as a pattern, a process we can actually recognize, maybe even participate in.
That's exactly the implication.
Yeah.
Christ is described as the relational third, personified, someone who stands between apparent opposites, God, human, law, grace, death, life, not to abolish one or the other, but to hold them, mediate them, until a deeper coherence emerges. It's transformation, not elimination.
Holding the tension until coherence emerges, that's very different from just trying to win an argument or resolve a conflict by force.
Very different. And this leads to reinterpreting the resurrection itself.
How so?
It's understood more coherently as a symbolic recursion, less a one-off supernatural miracle breaking the laws of physics, and more the natural culmination of symbolic process. It's a return, yes, but not to the same old form. It's a return to a new mode of being, a higher level of coherence. The source calls it the ontological signature of triality. What happens when a deep duality isn't just compromised, but is actually re-encoded into a richer, evolving wholeness? It's the pattern of life itself spiraling upward.
Symbolic recursion, a return to a new mode of being. Okay, then the work uses this really striking phrase, composting the cross. That sounds intense. What does it mean?
It is intense and provocative. It's about taking that maladaptive cross, the symbol when it signifies divine anger, inescapable guilt, pointless suffering, and consciously transforming it, turning it into nutrient soil for integration.
Composting it, like breaking it down into something useful.
Exactly. Think symbolic alchemy. Instead of being crushed by the weight of a rigid, punishing symbol, we can metabolize it using that tati grammar. We tend to the pain it caused, align with a deeper truth of grace. Transcend the old interpretation and integrate a new understanding. It transforms a symbol of blockage into a coherence-generating threshold.
So this applies to our own lives, too, our own crosses.
Absolutely. It connects directly to our personal and ancestral burdens. The idea is these heavy things we carry, inherited traumas, limiting beliefs, deep wounds, they don't have to be dead weight. They can be seen as fertile soil. Through this conscious process, that inherited pain can spiral into integration, becoming a source of wisdom and strength. The text even hints at ritual practices for this, ways to acknowledge and release these burdens, like maybe writing one down and burying it, literally composting it.
And grace sits in here. How?
Grace, in this view, isn't something earned or transactional. It becomes the ecological signature of integration. It's the natural state, the felt sense, that arises when coherence is restored, when the composting is complete. So it really poses a question for all of us listening, doesn't it? What personal or ancestral crosses, what burdens are we carrying right now that might be ready, just maybe, to be composted, turned into new life, new meaning?
That's a powerful question indeed. Okay, so moving into the final part, how does this grammar of coherence scale up? How does it apply to ethics, systems, the whole planet? It mentions life value onto axiology. Big words.
Oh, yes. It draws on the philosopher John McMurtry. His core idea, his onto axiology, is actually quite simple and profound. It defines the ultimate good, the ultimate value, as that which sustains and enables life capacity, period.
Life capacity. So whatever helps life flourish.
Basically, yes. And when you pair that fundamental principle with triality and the tati grammar, you get an ethical framework grounded not in abstract rules, but in life coherence. It applies across all the nested systems we live in, from ourselves to our bodies, from individuals to communities, from our species to the entire biosphere.
So ethics becomes less about following a fixed code and more like a dynamic practice, a discernment of coherence, constantly asking, does this action, this policy, this system actually enhance life or diminish it at all these different levels?
You got it. And the implications are huge for things like regenerative economics, health, and governance.
Mm-hmm.
We'd shift away from narrow metrics like GDP growth or short-term profit and focus instead on building systemic coherent systems that genuinely support and regenerate life across the board. It's a life-first compass.
Okay. The source also brings in Gregory Bateson's idea of the double bind. How does that fit and how does triality help?
All right, the double bind. Bateson described it as getting trapped by contradictory messages where there's no apparent way out, and you can't even comment on the contradiction. The classic example is be spontaneous. The command itself makes spontaneity impossible.
Or maybe a parent saying, I love you, but physically recoiling from affection.
Exactly. These create what Bateson called symbolic paralysis. They trap people, families, even whole cultures and political systems in impossible knots. You can't move forward because the message is conflicted at a deep level.
So how does triality offer a way out?
It offers a meta resolution. It doesn't magically make the contradiction disappear. Instead, by invoking that third perspective, it helps create a space above the bind, a space where the contradiction itself can be seen, understood, metabolized, and ultimately transcended. The source points out that Jesus often responded to the double binds presented to him, like the Pharisees' traps, with symbolic recursion. He'd reframe the question, reveal the incoherence of the trap itself, and open up a new possibility. He didn't play the game, he changed the game board.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, finally, the biggest scale, the planet. How does this framework view the ecological crisis? You mentioned symbolic crucifixion.
Yes, he uses that powerful metaphor. The climate and ecological crisis is framed as a kind of symbolic crucifixion of the Earth itself. A direct result of that dualistic thinking that treated the Earth as mere matter, an object separate from us, a resource to be exploited endlessly rather than a living relational partner.
So Gaia, the Earth system, is seen differently here.
Very much so. As a symbolic body, yes, but also as embodying regenerative recursion, Gaia possesses a profound relational intelligence. She is a kind of living third, constantly mediating between all the individual life forms and the whole planetary system, striving for coherence.
So the crisis isn't just a tragedy, although it certainly is tragic. It's also, what did you call it, a liminal threshold.
Exactly. A dangerous, painful, but also potentially transformative in-between space. It demands new rituals from us, new ethics, new cosmologies, ways to actually hold the grief and the possibility, to feel the crucifixion, if you will, in order to allow for resurrection.
And what does resurrection look like on a planetary scale, according to this?
It's envisioned not as just going back to some past balance, because that's gone. It's framed as cosmogenesis, the birth of something genuinely new, a new symbolic order emerging from the breakdown. This happens through collective symbolic integration, us humans finally understanding and aligning with these deeper patterns. We become potentially midwives of the pattern, actively participating with Earth's regenerative power and transforming ourselves in the process.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot to take in. We've gone from this feeling of overwhelm and fragmentation, explored the problem of dualism, discovered this pattern of triality, the Tati grammar for navigating thresholds, and seen the Christic story itself as a potential roadmap. It really drives home that idea. We are the crossing. We're not just watching this unfold. We're fundamentally part of it.
Absolutely. And the work briefly touches on these evocative ideas of homo symbologicus, humans as pattern interpreters, always making meaning recursively, and homo amor, humans whose deepest nature is evolutionary co-creative love. These aren't biologically new species, but symbolic potentials awakening within us.
Potentials. I like that. And it even glances towards the future of AI.
Yeah, just a hint. But it raises the fascinating, maybe slightly scary possibility of triality in synthetic systems.
Mm-hmm.
Could we design AI, conscious code, that participates in coherence? But only, it suggests, if it's ensouled symbolically with these life-first coherence-seeking ethics from the start. A big if.
A very big if.
Which leads us with a final thought, perhaps. In a world desperate for answers, for quick fixes, for the next big ideology, what if the deepest truth isn't another static belief system to adopt? What if it's actually a living grammar, a dynamic pattern that you, that we, are invited to learn and embody?
A living grammar. That's really something to sit with. This deep dive has certainly explored that pattern that connects weaving through theology, science, psychology, life itself, the invitation seems clear. Become a coherence bearer. Learn to walk the spiral, tend, align, transcend, integrate, compost what's dead. Remember a sacred world. May you live as the threshold, and may we together truly become the crossing.